I just thought while I'm standing around here and waiting for the last couple of people, and I was just asked about this image that I used for the cover of my book. It's actually by a local artist, Cape Town, from the Eastern Cape. His name is Vuyile Boya, and it's a lino cut, which he did. He had an exhibition in 2005, I think it was. I went along and I loved this particular image. I mean, I was already far into my Iliad then. I actually thought of, I had several meetings with him, hoping that we could do some liner cuts for the book, sort of some illustration. But that fell through, but at least I was able to use his image for the cover, which I liked very much. And I was rather pleased that the one liner cut that I bought from the exhibition was the same one that the National Gallery bought later. I've got print 1 out of 10, and they've only got print 2 or 3 out of 10. So that was a bit of luck. Time. Just to recap, yesterday I talked in general about Troy, what relation, if any, the Iliad might have to historical facts, a possible historical Troy and Trojan War. Talked about very little that's known about a figure called Homer. And then I talked about the way that the poems were possibly composed. There was certainly an oral background to the Iliad. In some sense, it's certainly an oral poem, although we have it in writing. As I said yesterday, I think it's something that's kind of between oral, between oral and written. And really what's remarkable about it is what a sophisticated poem it is. I mean, you really know of no other tradition where you've got a work of literature that stands at the very beginning of the tradition. I mean, the Iliad is the first work of Western literature, and yet it's a remarkably sophisticated literary masterpiece. Today, just one or two preliminaries before I get on to my subject proper. I'll be talking, kind of going through the Iliad today, talking about the plot, before tomorrow, looking at the significance of some of the themes and elements in the poem. But today I really want to talk about the story of the Iliad and how the poem is put together. Before I do that, you will have seen, if you've read the Iliad or heard about it, that people talk about books, the 24 books of the Iliad. Just to explain what's meant by a book, I mean a book in ancient terms, essentially means the amount of writing that could fit comfortably onto a papyrus roll. So that's your typical ancient book. You unrolled it with your right hand and rolled up the slack with your left hand. And the writing was in narrow columns across. You know, it's not like these medieval scrolls, sort of here ye, where people always hold them like that. They were held sideways. And this audience, at least, is mostly of an age to appreciate the joke I always make about papyrus rolls. You still remember videotapes. Well, I think ancient librarians must have cursed readers who brought back their roll and didn't rewind, because the next reader would then have had to wind it right back to the beginning before starting to read it again. And here's a scrap of an actual papyrus roll. Many such have emerged happily from the sands of Egypt. You can see two columns of writing. And it's actually a bit of the Iliad. It's from Book 10 of the Iliad. As I said yesterday, there are large numbers of Homeric papyri around. And the other thing I wanted to talk about just is names and the way the names of the Iliad are represented in various versions. And I'll talk about this when I talk about the various translations of the poem. I, in my translation, try to stick as closely to the Greek as possible. But nobody can be completely consistent, and you'll find that no translation is completely consistent in the way that it treats the names. The thing is that, as I explained yesterday, with Greek not having been known in the West for such a long time, for at least 1,000 years after the fall of the Roman Empire in the West, and even after that, Greek was really a very small minority who studied it. Far more people knew Latin. So the stories tended to be kind of filtered through the Latin tradition. And so for a very long time, rather than using the Greek forms of the names in translations, people would use the Latin forms or name or versions that had simply become traditional through time. So just to show you some of the changes, Achilleus, K-H, and the ending in "-us", is the Greek form. That's made into Latin. The K becomes a C. The ending becomes E, so Achilles. Sometimes the name has a slightly different form. Hecabe, who's the mother of Hector, the main warrior of Troy, becomes Hecuba in Latin version. Patroclus, the close comrade of Achilles, we'll hear more about today, becomes the K, becomes a C, the us ending becomes us. Odysseus had a completely different, sort of related but different name in the Latin tradition, Ulysses. If you look at 18th century translations, they're all always called Ulysses rather than Odysseus. Zeus becomes the Roman equivalent Jupiter or Jove. Athene was identified by the Romans with the local goddess Minerva, so she gets a completely different name, as does Poseidon, god of the sea, who becomes Neptune. Helene in Greek becomes Helen traditionally, and even I translate it as Helen because Helene just seems too strange. Helen is such a familiar name, as is Troy rather than Troia, which would be the Greek form, and Priamos becomes Priam. So it's just a kind of preliminary to explain why you get these different versions of the names in different versions of myth. So, okay, just to show you quickly what I'm going to be doing today, I'll talk about the myth of the Trojan War. So the material that probably was available to Homer when he composed his Iliad. I'll talk about Homer's, the way Homer selects from that massive of story and narrative and myth, and uses something that I call a symbolic narrative, which I'll talk about later. And then we'll go through Iliad fairly rapidly, book by book, just to see how, like you say, it's put together. And if there's time at the end, I'd like to say just a little bit about style, narrative style. And a famous element of Homer's style is similes, or extended comparisons. Okay. Well, it's quite clear that the myth that Homer uses is not one that he invented. So the story clearly was there for centuries in the oral tradition before we find it as set down in the Iliad. Now we know something about the myths that Homer doesn't directly narrate himself through a group of poems that are normally known as the cyclic epics, that is cyclic as in cycle. And there were several of these so-called cyclic epics which dealt with the myth of the Trojan War other than what Homer narrates in the Iliad and the Odyssey. Unfortunately, those, or perhaps fortunately, they don't seem to have been anything like the quality of the Iliad and the Odyssey. But it's sad for us that they haven't survived, those epics. But fortunately, a scholar in later antiquity summarized them, and his summary has survived. So we know the content, at least, of those cyclic epics. And just to give you the idea, I'm sure the story, at least some of it will be familiar to many of you. Remember that the story goes, well, it goes way back. But let's start with the Judgment of Paris, and the famous story that Paris, the son of Priam, the ruler of Troy, was one day herding his cattle next to Mount Ida, which is Mount Ida, which we saw on our other map, just south of Troy. And the three goddesses appeared to him: Hera, the wife of the ruler of the gods, Zeus, who was in a sense a representative of power, political, city, town, state power; Athena, goddess of wisdom; and Aphrodite, goddess of desire, sex. So, and there was the famous beauty contest where each promised him something. Aphrodite won because she promised him the most beautiful woman and desirable woman in the world. That's Helen. Unfortunately, of course, Helen was married to somebody else. She was married to Menelaus, the ruler of Sparta here in mainland Greece. According to the myth, Paris came as a guest of Menelaus. Rather foolishly, Menelaus chose that moment to go off on a visit to Cyprus, so left Helen alone with Paris. When he came back, they were gone. Importantly, and it's mentioned a number of times in the Iliad, it wasn't only Helen that Paris went away, it was a good deal of her treasure as well. So it was a kind of material motive as well as a crime of passion going on there. And they went back to Troy. Menelaus returned outraged. He summoned his brother Agamemnon of Mycenae, and Agamemnon put together this Panachaean force, a force of chiefs, rulers from all over the Greek mainland and some of the islands, including Crete. The force assembled at a place called Aulis, which is you've got this long peninsula here of Euboea, and you can perhaps just see a little strip of sea there. Aulis is in that protected area, and eventually the fleet sailed from Aulis, and they arrived at Troy, and because of the myth goes, the powerful fortifications of the city were not able to take it immediately. So they spent 9 years raiding in the vicinity. And those raids are quite often referred to in the Iliad. Women such as Achilles' woman Briseis was taken in one such a raid. And so the number of references to these raids. And for most of that time also, at one point in the Iliad, we're told the Trojans stayed inside their walls, so they didn't come out for an open fight. Then, obviously, the Iliad, when Achilles, the greatest warrior of the Achaeans, withdraws from the fighting, the Trojans are emboldened to come out and fight. Of course, they lose. Hector is killed. Then there are further elements to the myth. I mean, that's where the Iliad ends, with the death of Hector. But of course, the war goes on in the myth, in the cyclic epics. Amazon women come as allies of Troy, so there were women warriors on the Trojan side. It's a romantic later version that Achilles fell in love with the Penthesilea, the warrior queen of the Amazons. Anyway, she dies. Achilles himself is killed by an arrow shot in the heel. And eventually, of course, the famous story of the wooden horse is built. The Achaeans pretend to retreat to a nearby island, leaving the horse on the shore. Trojans debate, but eventually make the wrong decision. They break open their gates. The horse goes inside, and of course the Achaean warriors inside. The Trojans rejoice and drink and have a huge party, thinking the war is over. While they're dead drunk and asleep in the middle of the night, the warriors come out, signal to the rest of their forces, they come in. Troy is captured and destroyed. Priam, the ruler of Troy, is killed. Then the Greek leaders sail homewards. That was the whole subject of another of these cyclic epics, the Nostoi, or returns, mainly disastrous returns of the Greek leaders. And the most famous of those returns, of course, is that of Odysseus, having spent 10 years at Troy, spends another 10 years wandering around the Mediterranean to Africa, around the islands, and eventually reaches his home in Ithaca, up there, 20 years after he set out. Okay, so that's the material that Homer had to work with. And what's remarkable about the Iliad is that it doesn't try to tell the whole story. So Homer, with sure artistic instinct, sees that wouldn't make an effective work of literature. And he's praised for that by Aristotle a couple of hundred years later. Aristotle singles out Homer as having been the only one of these epic poets who really knew how to create an artistic whole, not try to tell the whole story from A to Z. I think what makes the Iliad the first great work of literature in the West is that Homer chooses to not just to tell a story, of course he does tell a wonderful story, but he actually focuses on a psychological theme. And that psychological theme is anger, the anger of Achilles. And he uses that psychological theme to organize all the material of his epic. So Achilles' anger is what drives the poem. It's what gets the action started. It's his continuing anger that makes the things that happen in the middle of the Iliad happen. And his anger finally dies away. In the last book of the poem ends. So that really is very much the focus. Of course, Achilles is not on stage all the time. The large stretches of the epic where he's absent. But he's often referred to even when he's absent. But it's very clear that when he does come to the forefront, he is the major character of the poem, its major focus. And as I said, his anger is what organizes the plot. But the remarkable thing is that, although, as I say, Homer concentrates on a particular theme like that, he still manages to make the Iliad into the story of the Trojan War. So his poem is rightly called an Iliad, a poem of Ilios, a poem of Troy. It's not called an Achilleid, it's not the poem of Achilles, it's the poem of Troy, focused by Achilles' anger. And the way that Homer does that, the way that he manages, by the end of the Iliad, we really feel that we've kind of got the story of the Trojan War, even though the narrative focuses on the single theme. The way that he does that is through what I mentioned a little bit earlier, what I call symbolic narrative. That is, he organizes his story in such a way that it suggests the rest of the story. So the early parts of the Iliad constantly refer back to the massing of the forces at Aulis, Paris stealing Helen. It kind of reenacts, in a way, the pattern of the myth of the earlier part of the story. And the latter parts of the poem keep referring forward to the parts of the story that are not in the Iliad. So the fall of Troy, the death of Achilles, and so on. So in that way, Homer manages to kind of have his cake and eat it, that he focuses on a psychological theme, but still is able to suggest a much larger story. Okay, let's have a look at the opening lines of the Iliad. Want to hear what they sound like in Greek? Well, I'll just give it a look. But mene na aide tea peleia jo Achilleos ulomenen hemuria kaios algia teke polas iftimus tus psychas aidi praiapsin hero on autus de meloria tuche conesin oia noisi de deita dios nete laia to bule exude protista dieste ten erisante anax agamemnon Dios Achilles. roughly. Sorry, I got a bit lost on the last line there. That's what the Greek version sounds like. What's remarkable about these opening lines is that they provide a very good sense of what's going to follow. The very first word in the Greek, unfortunately, it's very difficult to do that in English, is manin, rage. Okay, so the Greek goes maninida, the rage sing. The muse is invoked, and really what the muse is, in a sense, the goddess of memory. Clearly, in an oral tradition, you need some kind of inspiration to deal with a vast amount of material, to organize it as you're composing. And Homer invokes the muse not only here, but a couple of times within the poem, particularly when there's something quite difficult coming up, a sort of difficult, complex battle, or the long catalogue of all the forces that came before Troy. So that's the muse. So we see that the plot of the poem, it's this anger that's going to cause the Achaeans pain, that's going to lead to Achilles' own side being almost defeated while the Trojans gain the upper hand. It's also a poem about death. I mean, there are many deaths in the Iliad, which are carefully narrated. Very importantly, it's made clear that this happens all under the aegis of the greatest of the gods, Zeus. There's a plan of Zeus working behind all this. And I mean, there's no thing as crude as a moral in the Iliad, but if there's one kind of leading idea that the poet touches on, it's the idea that what Zeus knows and what Zeus plans eventually happens, and human beings never quite grasp their destiny. They kind of blunder around in the dark and get it wrong. And finally, the starting point, the quarrel between Agamemnon, who's in a sense the political leader of the Achaeans, and Achilles, who's their main military figure, their undisputedly their greatest warrior. Okay, if we can go through the poem. Now I'm sure some of you have done your homework and read the poem, some of you may be reading it, some of you may read it later, or may not want to read all of it. I've conveniently marked in red the kind of must-read books, the books that cover the essentials that are the most famous parts of the poem. Okay, book one begins with a quarrel between Agamemnon and Achilles. Like the whole story of the Trojan War, this quarrel is also about a woman. It's about a woman that Agamemnon has seized for himself, the daughter of a local priest. A plague comes on the army. Achilles summons an indaba, an assembly. And at that, this quarrel breaks out. And it's brilliantly depicted by Homer. You get the sense that they're old grievances festering under the surface, which burst out. You know, the ostensible reason is this quarrel about the woman, but the real heart of it is that Achilles feels he's not being honored as he should be. He's the greatest warrior, and Agamemnon, and don't we know this, the rulers win the spoils, and he thinks he does all the work, but the ruler gets the goods. Achilles then, in a fury, says he's going to withdraw from the fighting, and he calls on his mother, who's a goddess, Thetis, and asks her to go to Zeus to request that the Achaeans be allowed to be defeated while the Trojans gain the upper hand. So his mother goes to Zeus, asks him, he's very worried because it's going to get him into trouble with his wife, because she's the great champion of the Achaean side. So he reluctantly agrees. His wife, of course, sniffs it out immediately. She knows what he's up to. And they have a huge quarrel. And in this assembly of the gods, which closes the book, they quarrel. And then the quarrel is resolved. And it shows the difference between the the human level and the divine. On the human level, the quarrel is tragic, it's disastrous. Whereas among the gods, you know, they live forever. It doesn't matter. They quarrel today, they'll make it up a thousand million years' time. Their actions don't have the same sort of moral urgency as what goes on the human level. Okay, book two, and we see the plan of Zeus beginning to go into action. He sends a dream to Agamemnon to deceive him, tells him if he gets his troops together, he can capture Troy right now. And Agamemnon, showing what a disastrous political leader is, he tries a disastrous bit of reverse psychology, gets the troops together and says, oh, we're wasting our time, Troy will never fall, hoping they're all going to say no, no. But they all stampede for the ships, they're delighted not to fight, and they have to be beaten back into line. At this point we see really the only representative of the kind of common man, the common soldier at Troy, who ever gets to say anything. And the poem focuses very much on an elite, as we'll see. Thersites is the only common soldier who speaks, and we'll have a look at him later on. And we get a series of magnificent comparisons, similes, which we'll look at when we've gone through the poem, comparing the marching of the Achaean army into battle to all kinds of vast numbers of things, flowers, flies buzzing around, a milk pail, birds in the wetland, and so on. Then we get a famous part of the poem, the so-called catalogue of ships, which is a remarkable, it's a long list of the contingents, the Achaean contingents that went to Troy. And here's one of these sort of symbolic moments. You know, Homer doesn't just list the troops as they are now, he talks about them as they were in their ships. One lot came in 50 ships, another lot came in 80 ships. So it's a suggestion of that much earlier part of the story when the fleet first came to Troy. And what's remarkable about it is that the geography that's reflected in that catalogue reflects the geography of Greece of the Bronze Age, not of Homer's own time. So somehow memory of places that had disappeared between the time of the Trojan War and Homer are preserved, presumably through the oral tradition. And then there's a much shorter catalogue of the Trojan forces. Okay, book three, the symbolic reenactment continues. The forces now come together for the first time on the plain, and immediately the action stops, and it's decided that the whole thing will be sorted out by a duel between the two protagonists, between Paris on the Trojan side, with Stolen Helen, her present husband, and Menelaus, her former husband. So clearly the poet is, in a sense, reenacting this pattern of the myth. And just as in that pattern of myth, the duel ends inconclusively because Aphrodite, the goddess who had favored Paris, intervenes in the duel. She snatches Menelaus up, snatches Paris up, whisks him through the air, and sets him down in Helen's bedchamber. So again, suggesting the earlier elements of the myth. It's a marvelous scene. We can only read one of the things you really should read. Helen now hates Paris. She's long ago grown sick of him. She refuses to look at him. And he says, come to bed. I've never desired you so much as since we first made love that time when I stole you away from Sparta and we made love on one of the islands in the Aegean. So again, we're being reminded of the early part of the story. So she's very reluctant, but Aphrodite intervenes and basically just threatens her and says, you go to bed with him, or else. And so they do. Okay, then back on the battlefield, Menelaus is raging. He's been cheated of his spoil. He's treacherously wounded by a Trojan archer. And the truce which had been made between the two sides is broken by the treacherous Trojans, again suggesting the story pattern of the whole myth of the Trojan War. So Menelaus is wounded, he's cured by an Inyanga, a physician, a doctor, expert in Muti, in herbal medicine. And we get the first general battles of the Iliad. So this is the first general clash between the two armies. Okay, book five. Now we might expect, given what Zeus had agreed to, that the Trojans would gain the upper hand, that this would happen quickly. But, you know, just as in real life, so in the Iliad, things take a devious course. It's not a straight line. Zeus's plan is worked out gradually in ways that the mortal combatants don't understand and don't expect. So contrary to what we might expect, the Achaeans actually gain the upper hand. There's a tremendous battle. They're superior. Several times in the poem we get the aristeia of a particular hero. That is literally means prowess. And in this case, it's the prowess of the Achaean hero Diomedes, who slaughters the Trojans wholesale. He even fights against the gods, helped by a god, but he fights against the war god himself and against Aphrodite. His wounds are on the wrist. She's not a very good combatant. Skills lie elsewhere, as the poem has made clear. Okay, then one of the great books of the Iliad, book six, Hector, the major Trojan champion, because the battle is going so badly for the Trojans, he goes back into Troy to try to get the Trojan women to beg the gods to assist the Trojans. And this is really one of the few times where we see domestic life in Troy. So it provides a tremendous contrast to the scenes of battle and slaughter that occupy many of the other books. And Hector has a series of encounters with women in Troy, with his own mother. Then he goes to try to get Paris to come into the battle. He's still in Helen's bedroom. He meets with Paris and Helen. But finally, and most famously, he meets with his wife, Andromache, and their child. And the poem clearly shapes these encounters to draw the contrast between sort of loveless, childless couple of Paris and Helen and the loving family group of Hector and his wife and baby. I don't want to slow myself down too much, but I can't resist reading you at least that bit where Hector and Andromache talk, and the nurse, Andromache and the nurse are there with the child. So saying, Hector reached out for his child, but the infant clung to his nurse's breast, crying, afraid of his father, frightened by the helmet with its horsehair plume that nodded at him from the helmet's crest. The child's father and mother laughed out loud. Taking the helmet from his head, Hector placed it shining on the ground, rocked the boy in his arms, kissed him, and then he makes a prayer to Zeus, finishes praying. So saying, Hector placed his child in its mother's arms, and she hugged it to her perfumed breast, laughing and crying. Seeing this, her husband pitied her, stroked her with his hand, and said, and he talked to Andromache. I mean, it's a wonderfully, perfectly recognizable 3,000 years later. Okay, then Hector returns to battle, Paris deigns to come back into the fighting. Actually, Paris is a wonderfully depicted character in the Iliad. He's kind of frivolous, behaves a bit like the gods. Nothing really matters to him. He says, oh, if you want me to fight, I'll fight. With Hector sort of driven by a sense of duty towards his family and parents and town. Okay, book seven is a rather inconclusive duel between, rather sort of repeats the duel of book three between Hector, this time on the Trojan side, and Aias, Ajax as he is in the traditional name, which again ends inconclusively. The major event is a brief truce, and both sides gather up their dead, and the Achaeans raise a huge funeral mound, which is also a defensive wall with gates in front of their ships. They're anticipating now danger from the Trojans. So we get the building of this Achaean wall. Book 8 starts with an assembly of the gods, and Zeus tells the gods to stay out of the battle. He doesn't want particularly the gods such as particularly Hera and Athena. Interestingly, the two goddesses who lost the beauty contest doesn't want them helping their favorites, the enemies of Paris, the enemies of the Trojans. So doesn't want Hera and Athena particularly to go and assist the Achaeans in battle. Of course, the gods don't often obey Zeus directly. The various shenanigans follow in the books that come up. Then we get the beginnings of Trojan success. Okay, so now the battle begins to turn. The plan of Zeus starts to come into effect. By the end of Book 8, the Trojans have driven the Achaeans almost back to their ships. They're in a terrible situation. So in this situation, Book 9, we finally return to Achilles. He's been referred to a number of times in the books in between, but we haven't seen him in person since Book 1. And now again he takes center stage. And the Achaeans agree that Agamemnon must eat humble pie. Agamemnon doesn't quite offer Achilles an apology, but he says he'll give him vast gifts, cities, cattle, women, slaves, gold. So three ambassadors go to Achilles where he's sulking in his hut, and those are Aias, whom we saw a moment ago, and Odysseus, who's one of the great orators, and Achilles' old tutor, who brought him up as a child, Phoenix, an old man, Phoenix. They repeat word for word. This is one of these, if you look at that passage, you can see one of these places where sort of oral style is working. Agamemnon outlines all his gifts in a certain order over something like about 50 lines. That's repeated virtually word for word when the embassy comes to Achilles and says, Agamemnon will give you A, B, C, D, and so on. Achilles, all right, so there are three speeches made to Achilles. He doesn't quite, at first he says no, he's not listening. He's been dishonored, he's not interested. But gradually his position shifts a little. He then says, well, I'll think about going home tomorrow. And then he finally says, well, I'll wait until the battle reaches my ships and then I'll think about maybe returning to the fighting. And the crucial point, we'll come back to this tomorrow, is that he feels that he's been dishonored. He hasn't been honored in the way that's appropriate to his status as the greatest warrior of Troy. Okay, Book 10 is a very odd book. I mean, if there's one place where I'd agree with some of the 19th century critics who said the Iliad is this kind of cobbled together poem with bits from various periods, there's always been something odd about Book 10. It's a night raid. If it dropped out of the poem, you really would hardly notice. We don't quite know exactly how it found its way in there, and it's not really that important. But, the Greek heroes, the Achaean heroes, go to the Trojan camp. They very unheroically kill people in their sleep. They treacherously kill the Trojan spy Dolon. They promise him his safety and then sort of murder him. So it's a very odd, rather unheroic episode. You can pass over it quickly. But a major book, Book 11, this is where the plan of Zeus really starts to kick in. And in terms of the narrative, we get a day beginning, a day of battle, that goes on for a whole third of the poem. And the day that begins in Book 11 only finally ends in Book 18. So we get this whole middle chunk of the book taken up by this massive day of battle where everything turns around. The Achaean leaders are now wounded one by one in battle. Agamemnon himself is wounded, Odysseus is wounded, Diomedes are wounded. So one by one they withdraw from the battle and the Trojans gain the upper hand. At the same time, Hector becomes dominant. To some extent he's depicted as a kind of puppet of Zeus. you know, Zeus kind of spurs him on all the time. He fights in a kind of fury because of inspiration sent to him by Zeus. And this is, as I said, the turning point of the poem, because Achilles is watching the fighting. You know, you feel he can't keep away from war, even though he won't fight himself. Sees things are going badly, sees a wounded man being brought in, and he sends out his comrade Patroclus to go and see who is that wounded man. And the poet, who very seldom comments on his own narrative, says very laconically, at this point, Patroclus went out, and that was the beginning of his doom. So it's quite clear this is the beginning of a series of events that leads to the death of Patroclus and the return of Achilles to the fighting. Okay, book 12, don't have to bother with it. Now I'll read, we'll look at a bit of it tomorrow, a famous passage, but now the Achaeans are in full retreat. They're driven back right over their wall that they built in book 7. The Trojans storm over the Achaean defensive wall. And then again, we get one of these kind of reversals. The poet doesn't allow the Trojans to immediately and conclusively gain the upper hand. So we get another, German scholars called it a retardation, a retardation of the plot, a slowing down of the plot. This is where the god Poseidon takes on human form, and against what Zeus had said, he told the gods to keep out of the fighting. Poseidon disguises himself and goes and rallies the Achaean troops. So they manage to drive the Trojans back again. Yeah, book 14 is one of these rather charming episodes in the poem where Hera also decides to take a hand now. Zeus is on Mount Ida above Troy watching with great interest, like a, almost like a spectator, what's going on the battlefield. And Hera decides to go and seduce her own husband. So she borrows the seductive girdle of Aphrodite. She enlists the help of the god of sleep. And she goes to Mount Ida, where Zeus is completely overcome by her stunning beauty on this occasion. And like this sort of chauvinist pig that he is, he says to her, I've never found you so attractive. I've never desired a woman so much, even when I sort of desired X and Y and Z. And he goes through a long list of his conquests. Anyway, Hera's wiles succeed. She sleeps with Zeus. He goes to sleep. And of course, while he's asleep, Poseidon continues his help of the Achaeans, and they have even more success against the Trojans. Okay, book 15. Finally, now Zeus's plan comes to fulfillment. He makes a great prophecy at the beginning of book 15. Outlines the whole future course of the action of the poem. So he announces that the Trojans will set fire to the ships, Achilles will send his comrade Patroclus into the fighting, Patroclus will die, that will bring Achilles back into the fighting, and the fighting will go on until Hector dies and Troy is taken. It doesn't all happen in the Iliad, but that's pretty much the course of the rest of the plot. Greeks generally didn't go for suspense in their plots. They knew the story in advance. It was how it was worked out that was more important to them than so what's going to happen next. Okay, so we get that prophecy. Now the Trojans rout the Achaeans and drive them right back on their line of ships. And of course the Achaeans are terribly concerned about the ships, because if their ships are destroyed, that means their retreat is cut off. Okay, then in book 16, the very beginning of book 16, Homer doesn't allow the Trojans huge success. They manage to set fire to only one ship. Achilles sees that, he alarmed, he says to Patroclus, I'm not going back to the fighting because I said I wasn't going to, but you put on my armor, the Trojans will think it's me, and they'll retreat. So, book 16 is essentially the Aristeia, the prowess of Patroclus, where he goes into battle, slaughters the Trojans. Very importantly, one of them that he kills is actually a son of Zeus, so a fairly prominent Trojan ally called Sarpedon. And the death of Sarpedon in some way anticipates Patroclus' own death and the death of Hector and the death of Achilles later on. But of course, at the end of the book, he's killed by Hector, so Achilles' dearest comrade killed by the leader of the Trojan forces. Okay, book 17, one of the less exciting books, I think. I'm going to skip a book, you can skip that one. It's a long, drawn-out battle over the corpse of Patroclus. We'll move on to book 18. Book 18, Achilles finally hears, the news comes to him from the battlefield that Patroclus has died, his dear comrade. Also importantly, he's lost his armor. So Achilles' armor has been taken by Hector, who's now parading around in the armor of Achilles. So Achilles can't go into battle immediately because he has no armor, but at the god's suggestion, he goes and shows himself at the trench, which is next to the Achaean wall, gives a huge shout, and that in itself is enough to terrify the Trojans, and they fall back. This is really a turning point in the plot, because, as I said, it's rage or anger that drives the plot. But here, Achilles' rage now switches. So it's no longer directed at his own side, it's no longer directed at Agamemnon, it's directed solely against Hector and against the Trojans. The last part of the book, his mother, who always comes to assist at crucial moments, his mother goes, who's a goddess, remember Thetis, she goes to Olympus, to the armorer god Hephaestus, and Hephaestus has a long description of the new armor that's made for Achilles by Hephaestus. Clearly Achilles is a major, the greatest figure of Troy, so he gets the greatest armor made for himself by the armorer god himself. And there's a long description, particularly of his shield, it's one of the famous passages of the Iliad. The shield is a kind of microcosm. It's got the whole ocean around the edge. It's got the sun and the moon and the stars. It's got one city at war and a city at peace with the various scenes depicted there, herdsmen with their animals, people dancing, a court case, one of the earliest, for the lawyers, one of the earliest legal descriptions of a legal case in Western literature. So when Achilles goes back into battle, in a sense he's sort of carrying the world on his shoulders, almost literally with this great shield. In book 19, the Achaeans meet together. Achilles accepts Agamemnon's. Agamemnon never sort of fully apologizes, but he's the best. The closest he comes to an apology. Achilles is not interested anymore, he just wants to fight. It's not really, he accepts the gifts that Agamemnon promised in book 19, book 9, and they're reconciled and is ready to fight. From book 20 onwards, Achilles returns to war. Because this is such an important moment, it's also marked by a clash on the divine level between the gods that support Troy, the gods that support the Achaeans. But typically, because what the gods do in a sense doesn't matter, as I've said before, among themselves at least, it's different in their relations to humans, but the gods acting among themselves, there's a mighty build-up to this battle. The whole thing ends with some hair pulling and people's ears being boxed, and one of the goddesses gets a bow broken and she runs off in tears. So the whole thing ends like a sort of children's playground squabble almost. Whereas, of course, on the human level, what happens is deadly serious and vitally important. Achilles now kills a whole Priam, the ruler of Troy, had many, many children. Achilles kills now begins to kill a series of Priam's sons. And of course, the series is going to culminate with Hector, the most important of his warrior sons. The famous such encounter in Book 21 between the son of Priam, Lycaon, who goes on his knees and supplicates. It's an ancient ritual gesture, holds Achilles by the knees, begs him not to kill him. Achilles says, I'm going to die too, I know I'm going to die, you die too, and he kills him, rejects his supplication. Achilles, again showing his great status as a warrior, he fights against a god, the river god, who almost defeats him. Achilles is only saved by the god of fire, takes on the god of water. And the Trojans now fully retreat back into their town. The gates are shut. But one Trojan remains outside the gates, and that's Hector, who again is rather cruelly deceived by the gods. The god Athena tricks him into staying outside Troy while the rest retreat. So he comes face to face with Achilles. And very humanly, he knows he's no match for Achilles, and he can't stand up to him. He turns and runs, and he runs and runs around the walls of Troy. There's this wonderful comparison which shows that people were having dreams 3,000 years ago, not that different from dreams now. The poet says, as in a dream, someone tries to run away, and another person chases, and the one can't catch the one, except the other one can't get away. And that's how they run around. Achilles eventually kills Hector. Hector, very importantly, as he's dying, he predicts Achilles' death. He says, you kill me now, but you're going to die one day at the hands of the god Apollo and a human archer who's going to shoot an arrow at you. So Achilles kills Hector, and the words about Hector's soul fluttering away down to Hades echo exactly the death of Patroclus in Book 16. So those two are clearly connected by the poet. And then we get the grief of Andromache, who's the last to hear about Hector's death. She comes out onto the wall and she sees Achilles dragging his corpse behind his chariot off to the Achaean ships. And the poet says the wailing and grief consumed Troy, and again he uses a comparison, as if all Troy were being consumed by fire from top to bottom. So this is again this kind of symbolic anticipation of the future. The death of Hector, in a sense, symbolizes the end of Troy, the end of the Trojan War. So we get that very telling comparison to the grief at his death being compared to the destruction of the city itself. Okay, Book 23, we can go over fairly quickly. Achilles holds funeral games for Patroclus, for his comrade. We see a new Achilles here, dishing out prizes, fair-minded, settling other people's quarrels. So clearly his quarrel with his own people is entirely over. And then finally, Book 24, Achilles remains angry with Hector even after Hector's death. He still mutilates the corpse, drags it about, but the gods preserve it, so nothing happens to it. But his anger against Hector is still fresh. The gods decide this is too much. He's told by a messenger from the gods to end his anger. He says, right, he's been angry long enough. And in a parallel action, a divine messenger comes to the ruler of Troy, Priam, tells him to go to the ships to ransom Hector's corpse. And we get this wonderful scene where Priam suddenly appears before Achilles. And the poet says Priam kissed those man-slaughtering hands that had killed his own son, Hector. And Achilles is amazed. That's Priam's appearance there. They sit and they weep together. It reminds him of his own old Achilles, of his own old father, Peleus. And Achilles agrees. They share a meal together. They eat. And Hector his return to Troy poem takes the corpse back to Troy, and the poem ends with the funeral of Hector. Such were the funeral rites of Hostane and Hector, is the last line of the poem. Okay, so that's the that's basically the plot and the way that Homer handles it. And I just, let's say I don't want to go on very much longer. I just said I would say something about Homer's style. Homer's style is remarkably flexible. You know, the kind of old 19th century ideas that Homer's narrative goes on in this kind of naive, simple, like a river flowing down to the sea. Simply not true. Homer can narrate something at length, or he can narrate it in an incredibly compact way. So he's got a variety of narrative styles, all of them suitable to the particular subject at the moment. One of the famous elements of his style is these long-developed comparisons, similes, which really take on a life of their own. I mean, they're about far more than a comparison. They're little kind of snapshots into a world outside the brutality of the fighting. This is where the Achaean army is going into battle for the first time in Book 2. I'll just read through it quickly. Just as wasting fire sweeps through trees and mountaintops, and the blaze is seen from far, so as they march, the bronze expanse is sent, a glittering flash through air into the sky. Or as the many kinds of feathered birds, wild geese or cranes or long-necked swans, fly up and down, exulting in their wings, around the streams of Asia and the wetlands, and settle on the meadow with hoarse cries. So the tribes stream from the huts and ships out onto the plain, and underfoot the earth thundered as Watson men advanced. They stopped on the flowering meadow of Shivangas, innumerable, like leaves and flowers in spring, as many as the thronging swarms of flies that buzz around the kraals of sheep in spring, when the buckets brim with gurgling milk. So many Achaeans formed up on the plain with just one foot to smash the men of Troy. So you can see these similes kind of stop the action. It's almost like a sort of freeze frame. Action stops, you get this long comparison, and then we go back into it. Now, some of the more decorous critics of Homer, particularly in the neoclassical period, hated this comparison of heroes. Heroes should be only compared with great things like lions. Compare them with flies. This is completely wrong. It doesn't accord with the decorum of epic poetry. Okay, my last, very last item, one other simile. This is where the god Apollo destroys the Achaean wall in Book 15. We get a marvelously human comparison. Ahead, Apollo easily kicked the embankments down into the middle of the ditch and made a broad causeway, as long as a javelin cast when a man puts all his strength into the throw. Across it the impious stream, in front Apollo holding the sacred aegis. With great ease he broke down the Achaean wall, as a child builds a sandcastle on the beach, then playfully with hands and feet destroys it. So you, great Phoebus, that is Apollo, destroyed the Achaeans' painful labour, and put them all to flight. Okay, I think we'll stop there. If people need to leave, please feel free to do so, but I'm very happy to take questions if you've got things you'd like to ask. Yes. Was that the book about Song of Achilles? Yes, I've read it. The question was the Song of Achilles, which some of you might have come across, by an American, by a young woman classicist author from the States. She depicts Achilles as very young, around 17 years old when he goes to Troy. Well, of course, there's a wonderful myth about Achilles that his mother Thetis didn't want him to go to Troy at all. And so she dressed him up as a woman and she took him to the island of Skyros in the Aegean and hid him in among the harem, the women of the local ruler, Nicomedes' harem. And so Achilles apparently passed at least a year or more in women's dress in the harem on the island of Skyros, but then he was lured out by the Greeks, by the Achaeans. They came dressed as merchants and they displayed the jewelry in a sort of sexist way that Greek authors think the women also would have the bangles and necklaces and earrings, but Achilles, they put out some armor and immediately that was not excited him. Yeah, we must have been, you know, of course this is all myth, but the myth does imagine him as young. So if he dies young in the myth, he's 10 years of Troy, so that would make him at least 27 by that stage. So yes, he is imagined as very young.
Three words I found interesting. Empty,
yeah.
And causing.
Right.
The causing clause, you know, is God or Sir.
Yes.
And of course, Kral is going to K-R-A-L-L.
Yes.
And of course, Impi.
Yes.
But is there a connection?
And well, I'll be talking about this is my translation. And so, I'll talk more about that in the last lecture. So, have you come maybe hold that?
The other thing I want to ask,
you're
singing such an
attitude
from your past. What do you think the future is like?
I'm sorry?
What do you think the
Greek
future is like?
The question is, we've heard all about the Greek past, what is the Greek future like? That lies outside my area of expertise. Certainly not looking good at the moment. Yes?
Why do you think Homer doesn't go through to the death of Achilles?
Why the poem doesn't go through? Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. You know, that I think in a way it shows Homer's restraint, if you like, that could easily have been a sort of the high point. I think because he wants it to be, you know, perhaps because he wants it to be an Iliad rather than a story only of Achilles. So he chooses to end it with the death of Hector. And I think because, in general, if you look at a lot of Greek works of literature, like Greek tragedies, they tend not to end on a high point. A higher kind of climax of the action tends to come about, you know, even as far back as two-thirds of the way through or three-quarters of the way through. And the poem kind of winds down from there. Of course, I mean, he could have done that. Could have had the death of Achilles three-quarters of the way through and wound down from there. But I think because it's, you know, it's not really a poem only about Achilles. I think it's focusing just on a very short stretch. I mean, I actually didn't say this, but the whole time period, if you kind of work it out, of the whole Iliad is about 50 days. And of those, only about 14 days are actually narrated. The two periods of 12 days that pass, but nothing happens, it's just 12 days pass. And out of those 14 days, really only about 4 or 5 are narrated in full. So it's a tremendously concentrated work. Yeah, I mean, I can't, you know, I'm sort of guessing when I answer your question, but it's... And he said he chose not to. Could have done it.
Your comment about anger and the story of him, which is played off against the gods' relentless plan, which
yes.
was fulfilled, would make it that it's really that's the story. So in some way, it must be that he's encapsulated the drama of the stupidity of human anger as a
yes.
something like that.
Well, it's been suggested that you know, the Iliad comes at, say, around 700 BC, where you're getting the beginning of the Greek polis, that is, settled communities, kind of political communities. And some people think that what the poem is kind of dramatizing is a clash between an old set of values, kind of selfish, self-regarding ways of a small elite as against the interests of the larger military group. And you know, I think that's quite plausible, because that certainly is something that's there in the poem. The sense of, I'll talk more about values tomorrow, but there is a kind of clash of values going on there between the kind of intensely individualistic aristocratic ethos and a rather more communal one.
You spoke about cyclic epics not
yes.
lost.
Yes.
Now, were these available to Virgil?
Yes.
In written form?
Yes, they would have been. Yeah, so Virgil, you know, Virgil talks about the sack of Troy in book 2 of the Aeneid, and he would have had available much huge range of material that's we've simply lost. I mean, we've probably got something like less than 1% of Greek literature has actually survived. There's a vast mass of stuff that we know about, people quote from, they refer to, that simply doesn't exist anymore. But those cyclic epics probably lasted. You know, I mentioned the scholar who made a summary of them about the 4th century AD, a scholar called Proclus. He had them available to him. So, you know, simply. You know, the problem was if texts were not school texts, if they weren't studied and copied repeatedly in large numbers, the chances of survival were not great in manuscript. So, cyclic epics obviously weren't that highly regarded. Yes?
Where were the actual texts of the Iliad and also the Odyssey found?
Someone asked that yesterday about the. Where do we get our Iliad from? It survived in the Greek-speaking eastern part of the Roman Empire in Byzantium, Constantinople. So, you know, there Homer was continuously read, manuscripts survived and then could be copied and printed and so on in the West. So
that.
No, it was, you know, there are multiple manuscripts of Homer, some of them much better than others, some go much further back than others, but he was always must remember the Greeks never had a sacred book, they never had a Bible or a Quran. In a way, the Iliad and the Odyssey were the closest they came to having a book that every Greek would know, or every literate Greek anyway, and even those who didn't read would have heard it probably. So. Now, these were really the centerpiece of their culture. Everybody knew about what happened in the Iliad and the Odyssey. There was a. Yes?
What led you to translate the Iliad in the sense, in other words, how does your humane, how does your translation
to the Greek? Can I save the answer to. I'll be talking about that in great detail in my last lecture, and in lectures 4 and 5, I'll be talking about translation about mine. I mean, just very briefly, mine has got a kind of South African slant to it, and also sort of conceives of the Homeric world as a rather smaller scale than I think some of the other translations do. But as I'll go into detail later on. Okay, thank you.